That's classified.
It's what?
It's classified.
Had been deemed classified.
And B, that footage is highly classified.
Classified?
It's classified.
You can't tell anybody, but...
People need to know.
Welcome to CIO Classified, where you'll find candid conversations with the world's leading CIOs. In each episode, we have two different CIOs discuss a single topic. This week, we were joined by Michael Oberlander and Wade Sadin. Michael is a cybersecurity pioneer and globally recognized expert. Not only has Michael served in multiple security roles at Fortune companies, he's also written two successful books on security design and strategy. Michael is the current CISO at Logmein and today shares with us his highly sought-after insight. When a business outgrows their IT, they call Wayne. Wayne is an IT leader and board C-suite advisor who has worn many hats over the years, from CTO to CDO and CIO. In this episode, Wayne shares advice for managing a changing IT landscape securely. But before we get into it, here's a brief word from today's sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Asana. Asana is a leading work management platform that empowers teams to orchestrate their work, from daily tasks to big strategic initiatives, all in one place. By enabling the world's teams to work together effortlessly, Asana helps organizations of all sizes and industries achieve their goals faster. Learn more at asana.com. That's ASANA.com.
And now, here's your host, Ian Faison.
Welcome to CIO Classified. I'm Ian Faison, CEO of Caspian Studios, and today we are joined by two special guests. Very excited to have you both. First, Wayne, how are you?
I'm just great, Ian. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Michael, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining. Excited to chat about the state of cybersecurity, which as of recording today, it has been a crazy week in the cybersecurity world. We're going to talk about IT leadership and who better to have than both of you, longstanding CISO and a longstanding CIO for many years to talk about the similarities, differences, and everything in between. So let's start, Michael, with you. Tell us a little bit about your role.
Well, I'm the Chief Information Security Officer of Logmein. I've joined the company in March of this year, and it feels already like a year or longer. There's a lot of things to do, of course, as always. And I'm focusing on security in all aspects. Cybersecurity, IT security, information security, product security, call it whatever, IT, OT, and so forth, and covering that on a global scale. So really excited to be here and make great progress for the company.
And Wayne, tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Sure. Well, I've been a CIO, CTO, and CDO for over 30 years in financial services, logistics, healthcare, manufacturing, and other industries. For the last 10 years, I've advised CEOs, CFOs, a few CIOs, and board members in how to use technology more effectively. I worry about the risks and the opportunities of tech. And so it's a thrill a minute, and never the same, and always a new challenge.
Indeed, always a new challenge. This week was the Log4Shell or Log4J incident that happened. So keeping us all on our toes as a crazy week. We're not going to get into it, but like you said, always a new challenge. Let's get into the state of cybersecurity here. Michael, you're a multi-time author. You've written books on cybersecurity. What's the state of where we're at right now? How has it changed from when you wrote your first book in 2013 to now?
The last 3 decades that I can speak to is the lack of understanding in the business world that security is not going away. You cannot repeat, you cannot ignore it and shortcut it or underfund it. And the moment you do that, you pay the price later, as the current event that you mentioned is currently showing at every company on the planet, right? What has changed, in my view, is the sophistication of the attacker side, and the response and preparation needs to take this into account. And that is what's key to invest in both threat intelligence, threat modeling, similar subjects. That's my take on it.
As we've moved into this new era, this hybrid work era, everything has now shifted again. Employee experience is now more important than ever. Back in the day, it was the employees getting mad that they have to change their password every 3 months and being mad at the CISO for that. Now we have a whole new suite of challenges and things to be mad at the CISO about. You know, I mean, I jest, but what do you feel about how this like intersection of employees doing their jobs better and how that plays into cybersecurity and is going fast and being secure at odds? How are you thinking about it?
Great question. And I think it starts with the mindset. And we have, and we are heavily pushing for education, awareness, engagement, and the culture for that. And I've established here great resistance against phishing emails, for example. And we have also made sure that security should be designed in ways that don't hinder productivity and instead provide the easiest route to solve the problem. So that prevents employees and others to shortcut things and not following the advice. So if we make it easy to use, it's basically not a hindrance. It's not in their way. It is easy to use that makes security really embraced and then keeping that motivation, that kind of understanding and appreciation of cybersecurity high. And that works quite well.
And Wayne, from your perspective, from that CIO, CTO perspective, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I have to say I own both of Michael's books and I recommend them to everybody. I bought them with my own money because I'm self-employed, so they were worth it to me, and other people should buy them to understand the field and to understand how to move up in the field, because that's what Michael has touched on. From my perspective, what's changed over the last decade or so has been the amount of digitization has increased the threat surface. And especially with the pandemic, when a lot of physical processes were replaced by necessity with digital processes, there is no, let's go back to the old way of doing it that assumed we were all in an office. If you're all scattered to the four winds working from home or working from a satellite office or a Starbucks, it is very hard to go back to the old manual process that assumed I took the stack of papers and handed them to the next person. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we keep digitizing the physical world. So we're building the OT, IT bridges that years ago were separate. Many years ago, I worked in the utility industry. And so the controls, the SCADA systems running the generation and distribution business were not even accessible to the people in IT that did payroll and billing and that sort of stuff. It was locked in a separate room maintained by engineers, not IT people. Today, we've connected those things, sometimes deliberately and thoughtfully, other times accidentally, as we've had to just get an efficiency by hooking them together. In the old days, when somebody was hacked, you lose records, you have defalcation, you have inadvertent disclosure. In the modern world, when somebody hacks your system, stuff blows up and people get hurt. And so the severity of the threat in the physical world has become much, much greater. And from an employee experience perspective, we've kind of run out of password complexity. We've kind of run out of everything has to be unique, very hard password changed constantly. I've got 400 and something apps on my phone and 294 apps on my iPad. Can I have that many unique passwords and remember them, especially when everybody wants a letter, a number, a phase of the moon, yep, three special characters, and an emoji? No. So you wind up with password manager tools, and hopefully we move into two things. One is multi-factor, and the other is zero trust. So even if somebody gets in, if I can't do it, because I'm not supposed to, it doesn't matter if you figure out what I'm able to get into, you can't do enough to do real damage to the system. So I think we've got to be working in both areas to give a mix of employee experience and at the same time, effective security.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that your points on MFA and zero trust bear repeating here. How far, Michael, do you think your peers are away from that just being the new normal for everyone, or is that just where we are now?
Great question. In my view, the term zero trust is one of the most misused terms in the industry. And I think depending if you ask five people, you get at least six different answers. But I agree that zero trust is one of the many approaches that companies need to take. Some of them are close to that or are on their way to that. And some others have ignored this for decades. And what we have done here internally, we are pushing for MFA. As Wayne mentioned, we are doing the same thing, heavily MFA. We have backing from our CEO that even if it takes a few seconds or a minute over the day for the employees, we can do that. That really secures our applications, our systems, and the assets. And that's fair. That is the kind of culture that I want to have ingrained here. We are also doing the necessary education, as I mentioned, with videos and Slack channels and trainings and so forth. From a technology perspective, we are doing at a multi-pronged attack all the necessary steps like endpoint security, network security, data, cloud security, and encryption, all these things. That is the point, right? With zero trust, you have a certain way of thinking, how you segment or how you basically secure application levels, but you need to do a lot of things at once, and there's not a silver bullet. You need to do encryption, you need to do endpoint security, network security, data security, and there's plenty of things, and that kind of stack has evolved over the years, and it needs to be continuously updated because the hackers evolve as well. As I mentioned earlier, the nation states have the latest tools, so you need to know what is out there and then be prepared for that.
Hey, Ian, I want to make a comment on that. I work with a lot of clients, and they don't tend to be Silicon Valley tech leaders. They don't tend to be companies that hire people like Michael. They don't tend to be money center banks, the people who really invest in high-level security. They're the average trucking company, manufacturing company, construction company, those kind of businesses. And so what I see is a complete ignorance from the board on down. So I also want to take exception to something Michael said. He protects against the nation state attacker because he's got the easy stuff probably pretty well done. With the typical client that I see, the people get hacked by script kiddies, by the average everyday hacker who bought a kit from one of the dark webs. And so the challenge is also to maintain the nation state security, which some companies must do. But not getting hacked by high school kids in Romania is the goal of many of the companies that I deal with. And they fail even at that low level. And that's the challenge. So many companies are so bad at this because of technical debt, because of lack of basic cybersecurity hygiene, that the holes in most people's systems are enormous. And that's what I think as a society, we got to get everybody up to a certain minimum level. And then there'll be people like Michael's employer that works against nation states and very sophisticated attacks. And that's really the conundrum. The average company is not going to be aware of the risks of IT and not willing to spend the money, both physical dollars out the door, training money, time, and efficiency money. And that's the challenge we all face as IT leaders trying to get businesses more available, more secure, able to run with more situations happening.
So in those circumstances, like you said, do they have a chief security officer at those type of companies? Is it just the IT gal or the IT guy that is doing all that stuff? Are they dual hatted? Like when you're in a position where the entire board is ignorant to these sort of threats, where all the board members have the name of their children as their passwords or something like that and never change them, who has the responsibility there?
So from my perspective, I know what Wayne is describing. I have seen this myself. I have done this for 30 plus years, and there are those companies where security is an afterthought, where this is not taken serious, where the board is not listening, or you are not even talking with the board, and where there is no assigned CISO or CSO. Clearly speaking, those are the companies to avoid. It's important from a buyer perspective that you should focus to buy your products, services, the tools that you have for companies that take cybersecurity seriously, where you can see they have a CISO, they have the necessary commitment on public statements on their web pages, and there's plenty of indicators that you know what you're buying. And I think that has not been handled well over the last 3-4 decades by IT buyers. They were just purchasing the, quote, cheapest product instead of analyzing and checking and vetting, hey, is this really secure? I'll give you an example. We purchase new tools, new software. We do assessments. We do validations. We make sure that the products that we are purchasing have the necessary controls. And then only if they have that, if they provide that, then we are purchasing them / putting them here into production. And that is something that everyone can do, right? And I think that's a key step to take into consideration.
You know, Michael, what you're saying makes a lot of sense for companies that buy a limited number of generally fairly high-tech products. But remember how Target was hacked. The people who were fixing the refrigerators in, I think, Pittsburgh, their system tied into Target's accounts payable system, and the hack came through that company. So sometimes you don't have the luxury. You're not going to vet the people who deliver the coffee to your company. You're not going to vet the people who are taking care of the plants in your lobby. Remember when we had lobbies and plants. So that's the challenge with supply chain, I think. And so the challenge if you can vet, if you're vetting the people who do the plants and deliver the coffee, then great. That's what we ought to be doing. But I'd say you're the exception, Michael.
You are right from your assessment. The majority of companies don't do that. But what needs to happen is this consistent third-party analysis. Otherwise, you build your castle on sand, so to speak. You need to check out your third-party providers. And literally, the Log4j vulnerability that every software company on the planet is currently dealing with is exactly the proof of that, because it is third-party software, open-source software, and it is exactly the proof of that statement.
If you'd gone to SolarWinds and asked them, were they prepared? Do they have the right statement in their 10K? Do they have people with these job titles? They would have told you it's fine. Nobody asked them, is SolarWinds 1234 the password of your build server? because who would have thought to ask that? You know, I'll take it on a bigger level. When you look at technical debt in general, which is oftentimes the way stuff gets in, even the Log4j, depending on the version you're running and the version of everything around it, your vulnerability is greater or lesser. When you're looking at technical debt of any company you're doing business with, of anybody you're investing in, of anybody you're looking to buy, again, one hotel chain, I won't name it, bought another hotel chain and discovered there was an advanced persistent threat after the purchase closed. So we've got to be looking at every transaction, and bigger than just cybersecurity, I think the technical debt environment as a whole needs to be evaluated. If I'm going to acquire or invest in two companies, and one has 15-year-old Windows XP servers that haven't been patched, and the other one is running Amazon Cloud with all the right controls, which one would I rather buy from? Now, convince the procurement department of most big companies that that's how they ought to make their decision.
Seriously.
I'd like to see that CISO head of procurement discussion. You probably wind up in the CEO's office or even in front of the board if you're having to take trucking businesses, construction businesses, HVAC maintenance businesses, and bring them up to the standards that you're setting for your own company, Michael.
I love that. It's a great point. It's a fantastic point that it's like, where is the CISO and the diligence when you're buying these tools and how are you incorporating them?
Yeah, what I would like to say there is this. If you as a company don't have a CISO or you're not involving the CISO in these acquisitions decisions, right? That's a problem because then the CISO is not having the seat at the table that they need to have to make the necessary preparation, risk assessment, and advise the board and advise the C-suite what should happen. I have seen this in companies before, and it depends where you report to. It depends what kind of, if you want, political support you have to make these things work.
Absolutely. The CISO, and whether it's the CISO reporting to an overarching security organization, whether the CISO reports to the CEO, which may be common in technology companies, or whether the CISO reports to the CIO, which is common in, say, non-technology companies, you've got to have the political support. And to convince a board that is overseeing an M&A transaction that they ought to be digging into the cybersecurity internals of an acquisition target, that's a crazy conversation to be having with most boards. Again, I'm excluding money center banks, companies Google size and Google's technology, you know, Microsoft, the average flyover company and flyover country. These are concepts that have not been discussed at board levels or even in the CEO's office in most companies. And that's the challenge I think both Michael and I face. We've got to have a way to start the conversation and get people thinking about it, or they call him and they call me to tell us they've just bought something, go make it work in 60 days.
So let's go into that. Wayne, I want to get your take on this. How do CIOs prepare their technology stacks to embrace the future of digital work?
Well, as a CIO, you've got to be looking at, what do they say, where the puck is going?
Sure.
You know, pre-pandemic, how many of us prepared for everybody moving at home? The challenge we've all got, and now that we see that the next normal doesn't look like the last normal, and we recognize there's another next normal that we don't even know what it is coming ahead of that, we've got to be building flexibility. We've got to be building the ability to deliver whatever services the business wants, which means breaking down the monolithic stacks, breaking down the mindset of we have to do it in-house. We have to do it our way, the way we've been doing it for 20 years. We've got to adapt the IT department and the company to the idea that we set an architecture, a data architecture, a security architecture, a delivery architecture, and then move to a modular IT environment where we would be the stewards of the work and not necessarily the arms and legs of all the work. And of course, I will say, it's not DevOps, it's DevSecOps, or you're going to be scrambling forever. So IT's got to be making changes internally, because I'll tell you, moving a traditional DevOps security organization to a DevSecOps organization, let's think about one thing. You've got a head of ops, you've got a head of dev, you got a head of security. In a large company, they're each making $500,000 a year. They have big staffs. Guess what? You get to tell them two of you have a different job. One of you will be the DevSecOps person. The other two will find something for you. Don't worry. Or somewhere else. And so it's a cultural problem. Remember, too, that companies, and again, the companies I work with, have been using IT for 30, 40, 50. Banks started to put in computers in the 1950s. So imagine you're the fourth generation of IT in a company. Your great-grandfather started it, and now you work there. And so imagine all of the baggage you've got to change, all of the billions of dollars of mainframe code, all of the millions of pages of runbooks. And so it's a huge change. And don't minimize the change in IT. We love to change everybody else. We don't like to change ourselves any more than anybody else does. And so Michael in the security realm, others in IT in other parts of the world, of the IT world, we've got to be getting our own staffs to change. At the same time, we've got to be showing the boards and the CEOs the need for change and that it's not hopeless. It's not more money than we can afford. It's not longer than we've got to walk this earth. It can be done, but we've got to start somewhere. And that's both within IT and within the business.
And Michael, from a CISO perspective, how do you think about that? How do you think about preparing your technology stacks to embrace the future of digital work?
Great question. And I agree with what Wayne said earlier. The only term that I use differently, I don't call it DevSecOps, I call it SecDevOps. And I do this on purpose, and I want to explain why. If you take security to the front of the development process and the overall life cycle, you have almost already solved the problem because you have the necessary design. You do the threat modeling, you do the necessary scannings, the static and dynamic and component source code analysis and all these things that need to happen upfront. And then you can prepare the company. Another aspect, there is some risk taking if companies rush into the cloud. So the cloud is not a bad thing, but there's plenty of companies that rush into the cloud without having a proper governance model for that. And that's definitely a big concern. So you need to plan for your cloud usage and consumption and protection regime before you go there, or you pay multifold for it down the road. How do you store? How do you use? How do you manipulate and compute and transport and exchange and secure your data before you put it into the cloud? And that is where I see a gap in many companies and where CISOs and people like myself are thinking through from the get-go, what needs to happen here? How do we make sure this is safe along the production lines, along the life cycle of the product, the service? That's my take on that.
Let me comment on what Michael said. First of all, I'm going to start calling it SecDevOps because it's a brilliant formulation. I've always used the rule of thumb that said if it costs a dollar to do something in design, it's going to cost you $10 to do it in development. And it's going to cost you $100 to do it after you went to production. So shifting security left clearly helps dramatically in terms of both the security aspect and also the cost of security aspect and likely the convenience as well. So I think that's spot on. And I will, if I'm not using that, shame on me because Michael's right. But on the other hand, I want to say something about cloud. Cloud is another one of those terms that means lots of things to lots of people. So if you're talking the two bottom layers, infrastructure and platform as a service, I agree it's a deployment model. I think when you're getting into SaaS and you're buying an application, especially these industry cloud suites from the large companies, it is a change in the way you do business and a change in the way you do IT. But if you're taking your existing stack and moving it from your in-house data center or your colo into a cloud provider, then I'm in total agreement with Michael. I just think there is a bifurcation. SaaS is different than the others and have to be dealt with differently as a business.
I hear your point, Wayne, and I tend to agree. But the other points that I mentioned, that you have to have your governance model right, that is very applicable also to the SaaS model. And that needs to be conceptualized at the beginning of the project. And that is what I have seen in many companies fail because they rush it to the cloud. And then, wow, we need to rethink that, right? So that was the advice. But I agree in general.
Look, I tell my clients, you can outsource your hardware, you can outsource your software, just don't outsource your brains. You can't say, I've gone to Oracle or Microsoft or somebody, I don't need an IT department. You need a governance model. You need security architecture, you need data architecture, you need a deployment architecture, you need a service delivery model. And that doesn't change regardless of where the data is sitting and who is the custodian. Remember, as the CISO and CIO, we are the owners of that, even if we've allowed somebody to be our custodian, whether a colo or a cloud provider. Again, another big bank that went against Amazon and said, we got hacked because we didn't understand the nuances of your company. Shame on them. They should have read the manual. It's not to say, well, Amazon should have done it differently. So, Michael, I agree. you can't let governance go. And governance should be invariant. If I have a server here or there or there, governance is governance. Implementation changes, but the rules about how we manage data, how we store data, how we transport data, how we secure data, those should be invariant. I'm with you on that.
And what I've seen for many people, they are going into one of these cloud providers and the people do not read the SOC and the other such reports. So that needs to happen. And it is, to be honest, often not happening because the CISOs and other organizational units are under pressure to deliver and to do something. And that then creates burden down the road. So it's very important from a governance perspective to do this right and do it before you rush it there.
And now let's take a quick break to hear about our presenting sponsor, Asana.
This podcast is brought to you by Asana. Even if your team isn't in the same place, your work can be. You just need Asana. Asana is where teams securely coordinate work so everyone knows who is doing what, by when, and why. To learn why millions of teams worldwide use Asana, visit asana.com. That's ASANA.com.
I want to talk some predictions for 2022. Obviously, 2022 is upon us. How do you see work changing? Something overhyped, something underhyped? What are your predictions for 2022 and beyond?
From my take, the remote work is really long to stay. I predict that this is not going away. I'm pretty sure that this will stay with us for the next decades to come. And that's a good thing because it reduces our need to travel and pollution, the carbon footprint and so forth with all these environmental challenges that we face as a global population. I think that's definitely a good thing. And we are working on that to make it even better than what we have. And it's continuously to evolve. And I predict that this is leveraged and empowers employees even further. That means from a security perspective that companies really need to take into consideration how they secure the assets that the employee has under their control, like the endpoints, where they work, what kind of network connectivity you provide to them. How do you make sure that the person is really the person they say they are? So you need not only MFA, but a couple of other additional controls there. And then the kind of flexibility that is empowering the employee workforce, that is really a bonus thing. And I think the companies that are getting that are well set up for the future. There are dinosaurs that think everyone is going back into the office in 2023. No way. That's my take.
I've been saying what Michael's saying since the midsummer, back when Delta was first discovered and people were saying, we're all going back to the office or hybrid or 3 days a week or whatever. I started writing and commenting that these CEOs are delusional. I think there's a notion that the CEOs have that if I can walk into my office and see all these happy, productive people in their cube farms, somehow that is effective management. Remember, for most companies, the headquarters where the CEO works is 1% of the employees, 0.5% of the employees. Most people are toiling away somewhere else.
Yep.
So I'm with Michael. I think it's going to be a structural shift in the commercial real estate economy. Remember, we're going into the third year of the pandemic. And so if you're an employee and you're signing your third lease now, and maybe that lease is 5,000 miles away from headquarters. And so now headquarters says, come back. No, don't come back. Come back. Well, we're not sure. What does this tell employees? And so I think the CEOs have got to stop deluding themselves that we're coming back, as Michael said. But this is an opportunity. Look, if you're a CFO, you're managing a huge real estate portfolio. There's an enormous amount of sunk cost. If I've got $50 million invested in FF&E and $50 million in commercial real estate, I should be dumping that before the market craters. And you're seeing that commercial buildings are being repurposed to senior centers, delivery centers, warehouses for the supply chain. It's time to get out before the market goes down. Look, I'm a New Yorker. I worked on Wall Street. I worked in tall buildings and got there by subway years ago. Who wants to commute in a horizontal COVID tube to then commute in a vertical COVID tube to sit in a cube? And by the way, with all of the equality initiatives, companies are saying we cannot disenfranchise the remote worker. So if I'm sitting at home and you're sitting at the office and we're worried about COVID, we tell employees, sit at your cubicle and take the meeting on whether it's whatever technology yep. you're using. So here we go. I commute an hour to go sit in my cubicle. I'm not supposed to get too close to anybody. So I can participate in a meeting in the Hollywood Squares boxes. Why did I go to the office in that case? And this is what the confusion is for me. Executives will tell you the corporate culture is changing. Culture, look, I'm an old guy. I remember when a telephone had a long cord and to have a private conversation, you stretched it into the closet and sat there with the door closed. And our parents sent us out to go away, and we didn't come back for 12 hours, and they didn't know where we were. I've got a 28-year-old daughter. She is partly the screen generation, partly the talk-to-people generation. Look at the people coming out of high school now entering the workforce. They've had screens since they probably could use their fingers to push. The culture isn't worse. It's not bad that we communicate in emojis and in raised eyebrows. It's just different. And so my father's generation complained about him. He complained about me. I complained about my kids. And we've got to accept that the workforce made of Gen Z is going to be different than the workforce made of boomers. And this is the opportunity, as unwelcome as it was and unlikely as it is, to start pushing the culture change to make room for a next generation model of how we work. I'd rather have a connection with my family than my coworkers anyway. And that's what working from home gives me and you and Michael and everybody else. And so I think that's a huge change.
I agree that Wayne put it very, very good there. I live in Houston, right? I would have to drive at least an hour to my office seat and another hour backwards in the evening. So that kind of time I can use here productively, just taking a phone call with Australia. And then the next, with a click of a button, I go to India, I go to Europe, I go to South America, South Africa, and North America. It is all there with a click of a button, very easy to do. Imagine this, all the great resignation that has happened in companies all over the place would happen again if they force them to, because all the people that have seen the beauty and the benefits of remote work and using our products, right, the GoToMeeting and GoToWebinar and all the stuff that we have, now suddenly they should go back to the office. Why should they? So I can only advise not to do that and give the people the freedom. And as Wayne said, let's develop a future model that really, if there's any negativity with this remote work, I don't see it, but if there's any negativity that someone has concerns, you can find a combined way. I will still fly to certain meetings or to go to certain conferences I want to have a meeting in person, but like 80, 90% of my time being productive from home is so much better. I love it.
I think there's a huge pressure with the way that senior executives have been prepped and managed with assistants and meetings and everyone coming to their conference room, that the world has been crafted around them for so long. Many of them manage with an iPhone, right? That's just how it is. You never actually really need to work on a computer ever, because what do you need to do? You're just making decisions. You're just in meetings. And so I think that the idea that the actual people sitting there on a laptop doing the actual work, what they need to be successful is so different from what the executive team needs to be successful. Every CEO, their number one problem is, I need to find talented people. Well, guess what? The talented people are not going to work for your company if you have a stop-start situation when they can go work for somewhere. And like, some people will want to go to work for companies that are in person. Other people won't, but you have to acknowledge that.
I built satellite offices for a bank in Houston many years ago for the traffic reasons Michael talked about. So we had bank branches, and we allowed people to physically go to a bank branch where I had internet connectivity and internal network connectivity 25 years ago, because we didn't want people to have to suffer the commute, and we didn't want to lose employees to that. And that's what we've got to be doing today. Allow for satellite offices, allow for pop-up offices. I've spoken at conferences where people came together. So there are reasons why it may be worth it to come together periodically. But I've also been in a virtual bourbon tasting where a company sent me and everybody else a little test kit from some bourbon company, and everybody got the kit. We can build a cohesive company culture that doesn't involve physically standing around each other and the loss of productivity. We've got to build tools that allow us to be flexible, to be responsive, and not just come together for that scheduled meeting, and have a way to be exchanging knowledge and information. I think that's what everybody says is getting lost, is the accidental serendipitous conversation. How do we encourage serendipity? One of the things I do is I just moved to Dallas, and I make it a point to try to go to meet two people a week that I don't know. Meet them for coffee, meet them for lunch. But how do we all make the effort as senior executives not to just consume the culture, but to shape the culture? And this is what I've told executives. When you're doing a change management program, whether cybersecurity, ERP, whatever, the senior executives have got to model the behavior and walk the talk. It's no different. Culture is vital. So let's shape the culture we want in the future. Let's make it a diverse and inclusive culture. One thing we haven't mentioned is if you're a neurodivergent, if you have a physical handicap, if you have transportation issues, you've been excluded from the workforce potentially. With this current work from anywhere model, we can expand our workforce to people who aren't, how do I say this, like us in all ways, but are very valuable and vital contributors to the corporate ecosystem. And so we've got the opportunity to shape a much more diverse and inclusive culture if we are thoughtful about it, if we are intentional about it. If people that are shy never get to speak up, if people are marginalized because loud people like me dominate the screen,
yeah,
that creates a culture that is not what we want. How do we shape it? And as executives, as CHROs, as business leaders, we've all got to figure out a way to change our culture to fit the reality of the world and the changes in our upcoming workforce.
I want to get to our last couple of questions here. In a second, I'm going to ask you both what questions you have for each other. So start thinking of that. But what is one secret that you've learned in your career that not enough C-level execs know?
I got that one. I've always heard, as a technical person, an IT person, we got to meet the business in the middle, right? We're going to meet them halfway. The secret is you can't meet them halfway. We're the technical experts. We got to go 80% of the way. They're not going to learn half of our jargon while we learn half of theirs. If you're an IT person, especially a CIO or the level below that, you are in the marketing and communications business. You are selling ideas and concepts. So meet them as far as you have to get the point across. And that's what I see that not enough IT people do.
Good point. I agree there. From my perspective, I would say don't spend too much time on technology details. Instead, focus on what sticks long time, like methods, values, partnerships, and leverage those. And relationships also cannot be underestimated. I think if you can't meet in the middle, then meet at the 80% or so. But you need to have these relationships that are long-lasting that help you accomplish that. That's my take there.
All right. What questions do you have for each other?
I'll ask a question to Michael. So, Michael, I work a lot with boards of directors. So what is the one thing you wish I could convince boards of directors to understand?
Awesome. And I wanted to ask you, how do you tell the board to spend the money for cybersecurity before the breach instead of after it? I have seen this for 30 years, the same story everywhere. Mm-hmm. How do you convince the board? So what's your take there, please?
So, okay, I'll answer the question first. Remember, you've got a board of directors that starts with the notion that they have to know everything. Boards of directors are omnipotent and omniscient in the eyes of the employees. They're supposed to see all and know all. Boards of directors were 50s, 60s, even 70s. When they came up in their management training, when they were in their 20s, we're talking 1980-something. So IT in 1980s, we called it DP back then, was a guy like me wearing a white coat, pushing a cart on which there was green bar paper. And I dropped off the monthly production report, the monthly inventory report, the monthly sales report. And modern IT is now this thing in my hand, or this thing, the tile that I'm sitting here with, and the board is scared to death. They don't know what that means. So education is important. The other thing is, especially in cybersecurity, every board I know is scared to death of a derivative lawsuit. Is it going to be SolarWinds? Is it going to be the next breach? A derivative lawsuit, for those that don't speak board language, is a suit that's brought against the directors themselves. And those rarely succeed unless you can prove a director should have known something and didn't in the duty, what's called the duty of care, what they're supposed to know and manage. And so they're all frightened to death, I'll be very honest. And so you've got to tell them stories that relate their experience in DP to what you're doing today and help them understand how what you're doing protects them from breaching the corporate veil and a director's derivative lawsuit succeeding. The derivative lawsuit, by the way, takes the director's money out of their own bank account. Their D&O insurance is pierced, they don't get paid, and they lose everything. The first time there is a successful breach of that corporate veil, you're going to find a big change, Michael. It'll be very easy. But until then, it's about showing them how you're protecting their personal liability and personal assets and educating them at the same time. I have a rule of thumb. You probably see it, Michael. Go to a board meeting, you go to the CEO, and somebody eventually goes, I'm going to ask you a stupid question. And they kind of do it like apologetically. And I used to just answer the question. I don't do that anymore. I look them in the eye and I say, there are no stupid questions at your level. Number one, because you're the CEO or the board member or whatever. Number two, because you're paying me to answer you. And that's what we've got to be able to do with the board, is reach them so they understand it and they recognize that their concern may not be unwarranted if it affects them. So that would be my two strategies, education and not fear, but healthy understanding of the risks.
Yeah, very much agreed there. So I have also done the education to showcase how easy it is to overcome certain controls or bypass the human firewall, so to speak, and how to get into systems regardless of the money that you have spent. And what I try to tell them is, if you spend the money upfront for cybersecurity, you spend 100% or less than you have your data breach. And it's so important and so smart to do it right in the get-go, to really spend the money upfront. And depending to whom you talk and how you talk, and you need to convince them this is necessary, spend it upfront and not wait until the data breaches.
The problem with spend it upfront is everybody says, why do I want to spend money on insurance if the chances are so slim? Remember, fundamental risk equation here at risk is severity times frequency. So you've got to convince them the severity is so high that even if the frequency is relatively low, you've got an expected value that's worth fixing. The insurance companies are helping us there as they're starting to raise the price on cyber policies and as they're starting to reduce the payment. Remember how the board thinks of this. They don't think like Michael does or even like I do. The board thinks, here's an amount of money. If I can lay off the risk of a cyber breach or a failure of an IT system on an insurance company, I'm made whole. So we have this whole notion of risk and laying it off on insurance companies. We could all self-insure, I suppose, if we had all the money in the world, but we don't. As the cyber companies underprice their premium, their underwriting wasn't good. So you could pay a dollar and get $3 worth of protection if you did the math. Now they're starting to tighten that. So all of a sudden, your cybersecurity is costing twice what it cost, three times, and the number of conditions they're covering is shrinking. So that gives Michael, a guy like Michael, a CISO, a chance to meet up with the insurance person in the company and go see the CFO and the CEO and the board together. The other thing I think that's widely underestimated is your insurance underwriter for cyber gives you tremendous tips. If you would do this, your premium would go down by that. And that's a powerful tool to go into the board with. Our premium is X. We could reduce it by Y if you give me half that money to invest in the technology. The other friend that we don't use enough is the auditors. Typically in a business, IT is over here and cyber is either with IT or separately over here. And there's an audit function over here, internal and external. The audit bill is probably not looked at by the CIO, possibly not looked at by even the CISO, but it's not insignificant. So go find your head internal auditor. Go look at the audit bill and figure out if you automated the authentication, if you did role-based security, if you did zero trust, if you automated a process, how much would that cut your audit bill? There's some natural partners that I don't think IT people take enough advantage of that would be a very powerful story to tell the board, the CFO, and the CEO.
Agreed, Wayne. And also what I have observed is that the insurance companies are tightening their questionnaires and are really making sure that you are doing the necessary controls, that you are really doing what you're saying. I also agree on the audit. So I have always partnered with internal audit or sometimes external audit. And that's a good ally. Agreed there.
Yeah, it's always easier to tell the board, KPMG made me do it, or the insurance company is telling us we have to do it. And, you know, a good underwriter understands not only your business, but understands your industry. They would see things you wouldn't see working in one company. And so taking the underwriter's recommendations, not all of them, but you got to look at them, you can get some tremendously good ideas. You can come back with a lot of information. And I dare say most CIOs and probably many CISOs don't spend enough time with their cybersecurity or business interruption underwriters asking them for tips, asking them for suggestions, and asking them for material they can bring to the board. X number of companies had these losses, according to this insurance company, makes a powerful argument that has numbers as opposed to opinions. Without data, you're just another person with an opinion. With data from a third party, you can make a much more powerful case.
Gentlemen, I love it. Thanks so much for joining the show. We really appreciate it. Obviously, go check out Michael's books. We'll link them up in the show notes. If you're a CIO or CTO or somebody looking for IT help, go to Wayne. Anything else, gents?
So I really enjoyed this discussion. I would love to continue. I think we brought the most important point home. Cybersecurity is not going away. You can't shortcut it. You need to do the necessary investments up front. We have the security tools available. Let's put them into place. Let's bring these products out there. Of course, I want to say that LastPass is really a good solution that can be used in the market. I can only recommend that.
And my last thing will be a message to the board. But first, I have to say, I told Michael when I saw him the other day, I personally bought LastPass for my family. And it's not because I knew Michael. I didn't even realize his company was LastPass. But my message is for the board. Sarbanes-Oxley, 20-some-odd years ago, decreed that boards would have a qualified financial expert when they realized board members couldn't read financial statements. Enron and WorldCom proved that. In 2016, Russell Reynolds wrote a very significant article, The Rise of the Qualified Technology Expert in the Boardroom. I recommend that to everybody on boards. They said that qualified technology experts, analogous to QFEs, were needed to provide risk oversight and opportunity oversight at the board level. And I can't say that strongly enough. We have reached the point when technology risk and opportunity and investment is so high that it would be a breach of the duty of care for boards not to understand the implications. Not the technology, but the implications.
I love it. Great final advice. Thank you both. Appreciate it. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to CIO Classified. This episode was brought to you by Asana. From everyday tasks to big picture goals, Asana securely organizes work, so teams know what to do, why it matters, and how to get it done. Plus, with more than 100 integrations, Asana brings together everything your team needs to communicate, collaborate, and coordinate work in one place. Visit asana.com to try for free. That's ASANA.com.